Welcome to the Minor Consult, where I speak with leaders shaping our world in diverse ways. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Carolyn Bertozzi. Here at Stanford, she's the Ann T. and Robert M. Bass Professor in the School of Humanities and Sciences and a professor of chemistry with courtesy appointments in chemical and systems biology and radiology. She's also the Baker Family Director of Serafin Chem H, which is devoted to bridging chemistry, engineering, and medicine to benefit human health. Carolyn was awarded the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 2022 for founding the field of bioorthogonal chemistry, the study of chemical reactions inside living organisms without disrupting their natural biological processes. Through these reactions, scientists around the world are advancing their understanding of how cells function to develop better tests for infectious diseases and improve the targeting of medical treatments, such as cancer pharmaceuticals. Carolyn, welcome to the Minor Consult. It's great to have you here today.
Thank you so much for hosting me. It's my pleasure.
So, Carolyn, it's my understanding that your love of science was encouraged from a very early age. Can you tell us what sparked your interest and why you chose chemistry as your career focus?
Well, you know, I actually grew up in a family that was rather focused on science. My father was a physics professor at MIT, and he was an experimental nuclear physicist. And what that meant is that he had a lot of gadgets at work, and he would bring them home sometimes, and we would play with them, like toys, when we were kids. So I grew up with, for example, back then, MIT had a mainframe computer, and you could have a terminal at home that you plugged into your telephone. You probably remember those days where the phone would make all of these noises, and that was the communication with the terminal. So we had a terminal and a modem before anybody else did, and we were playing with these things. So it was definitely in our household that science was fun and cool and everything. But I didn't really discover chemistry until I was a college student. And what happened was I thought I might be a pre-med. So I started college taking the pre-med requirement courses just in case I might want to go to medical school. And one of those pre-med requirements is the course organic chemistry, which most of the pre-meds didn't really care for too much. It was sort of had a reputation as a difficult kind of weeder course. I don't know if that was true in your experience, but but unlike all the other pre-meds that didn't really like organic chemistry, I really took a liking to it. And I found that it really, really clicked with me. And that just became my passion pretty much after that.
In fact, I remember a conversation we had because my organic chemistry professor was a colleague and friend of yours, David Kane at Brown. And I too enjoyed organic chemistry. And what was it specifically about the field? Because clearly you've risen to be one of the world's greatest leaders in the field of organic chemistry, and you've advanced the field forward. But what kindled the original fascination and passion for the field?
You know, I remember it seems somewhat trivial now to say it, but honestly, it was how visual it was as a science. I loved drawing the molecules and sketching them out, and I always liked sketching things and doodling and organic chemistry really like activated that part of my brain, I guess. And I love the idea that you would draw structures of two molecules, and based on what you saw in those structures, you could make predictions about how they would react with each other and what product they might make in a reaction. And so just the idea that these two molecules would come together and the atoms would rearrange and make a new form of matter, and that you could actually have some prediction about this, and you could engineer a chemical synthesis to make a new form of matter that didn't exist on the planet until you made it. I thought that was really cool.
Great. And as you pursued a career in scientific research from your undergraduate to your graduate studies, you've spoken about feeling like an outsider at times. And what was it like to study chemistry when there were very few women in the field? And what obstacles did you face as a scientist in the LGBTQ plus community? And how did you navigate these challenges?
Oh, there's a lot to unpack there. I didn't realize that that women were minoritized in chemistry until well into my college years. And I think the reason that I was somewhat oblivious to, you know, the stereotypes, I guess, against women in science was that since I grew up with two sisters, so there were three girls in my family, and since my father was promoting sciences so enthusiastically to us since we were little kids, I had no idea that in the world at large, this wasn't the case. This wouldn't be the experience of most girls. So I didn't grow up thinking that girls couldn't be just as good at science as boys. I never had that thought in my head. And it wasn't until college when I tried to break into research labs, as a summer researcher as an undergrad, that's when I first experienced the headwinds. Because at that time, the field of organic chemistry had a bit of a culture that was, nowadays you would use the term toxic masculinity, you know, that's the modern term, but back then it was just very unfriendly to women from the top down, right? So the, even the professors at the time that were my teachers of my classes, they did not take women into their research labs as a matter of policy. And you know, people just got away with a lot more stuff like that back in the 1980s. So it took me a while to find my way into organic chemistry, and it didn't happen until I was a graduate student. And finally, I found an organic chemistry professor who was a brand new young assistant professor, not that much older than me at the time, and he opened his door to women, and I was able to do my PhD in an organic chemistry lab. So that was a frustration, and it was a life lesson, right, that has stuck with me and has informed my own approach to creating a more diverse, welcoming lab. In terms of the headwinds around being a gay person, in the 1980s, it was a different time, and, you know, gay people did not have civil rights. We didn't have equality under the law, much less in culture at large. So, you know, I, of course, had to deal with that, but my strategy was to situate myself in geographies where I had a better shot, you know, at having a peaceful life and a fulfilling career. And that's what brought me to the Bay Area. So, you know, I'm from Massachusetts, and when I was looking for a graduate program, I focused entirely on the San Francisco Bay Area because I thought that was an ecosystem in which a gay person might be able to live a productive life. And I think that was a good decision.
Indeed. And when you began your postdoctoral studies in the 1990s, the idea of chemical biology, that is the study of chemicals and chemical reactions involved in biological processes, was still in its infancy. What made you interested in research that included both these fields, and it also touched on biomedicine?
I was really fortunate that I was just entering graduate school. This would have been around 1988, at a time when chemists and biologists were starting to come together in academic environments. You know, the interesting thing is chemists and biologists have worked together for a very long time in the pharmaceutical industry. I mean, you have to, right? To make medicines, you have to be able to make molecules and understand how they affect biology, right? So it's not like chemists and biologists hadn't been communicating, but in academia, they were very siloed. And in the late 1980s, those silos started to erode a little bit. And so when I started my graduate training, it was just at the time when a new field called bioorganic chemistry had been coined. And the professor I worked for was one of the early people who wanted to take the skills of the chemist and deploy them to study biology. And so I was trained with that sensibility starting in grad school. And then by the time I started my own independent lab, and that was now in the mid-1990s, it was becoming more fashionable, I think, for chemists and biologists to talk to each other and collaborate more and create graduate programs that span the disciplines. And so I just got on that wave right as it was cresting, and I was able to surf that wave in the early days of my career. Yeah. And I think the boundaries between chemistry and biology have continued to erode. And at Sarah Fan Chem H at Stanford, you know, we feel like we are at the leading edge of training people equally in chemistry and biology. And I don't think any of our students today would see that boundary.
Exactly, exactly. Maybe to continue on that theme and specifically bioorthogonal chemistry, I love a quote that I read from George Whitesides, with whom you worked as an undergrad at Harvard. And the quote is, most organic chemists thought it probably wouldn't work, that is, bioorthogonal chemistry, and the biologists felt the chemists shouldn't muck around in living cells. He goes on to say that it was an idea that was without precedent, and you've talked and written about that. And I'm curious, did you have a sense at the time, because you truly were and are a pioneer, did you always have a sense it was going to work, or were there doubts that you had? And what along the way gave you the encouragement to remain so dedicated to founding and developing this field of bioorthogonal chemistry?
Well, you know, early on, you're right, George Whitesides is correct. There were a lot of skeptics from both sides of the aisle. And of course, you never know in science whether your idea will come to light in your lifetime. You know, if you can't get it to work, maybe somebody 100 years later gets it to work. You don't know. But at the time, I felt like the concept of having two reagents, two chemicals, come together and form a bond in a biological system as complicated as the human body, it seemed like it should be possible, because the truth is there's chemical reactions taking place every microsecond in the human body between molecules that very selectively come together and form new products, right? We have biochemical pathways unfolding in our bodies all the time. So it felt like if you could just find the right types of molecules and tune the reactivity just the right way, it should be possible. And then really the challenge was finding the right chemicals and tuning them the right way. And we spent, I would say about, you know, the first maybe 8 years of my lab at Berkeley was focused on the choosing and the tuning, right? And that's all we did for many years. And finally we were able to get those reactions, you know, engineered exactly to do what we want them to do. But it was a process. It was very iterative. Right, the first chemical reactions we invented weren't perfect, and we had to keep iterating and perfecting and iterating and perfecting. So it was a process, but we had some early hints of success that kept us very motivated.
And then fast forward a few years, and then to Wednesday, October 5th, 2022, when you got a call in the middle of the night from a Nobel Committee member informing you that you'd been selected as a Nobel laureate in chemistry. How has your life changed since then, and what new experiences has this distinction brought?
That's a good question. You know, the most immediate impact on my life has been, there's more visibility that comes with a Nobel Prize compared to any other recognition an academic might get. So I've had a lot of requests for podcasts, for example, here's one of them, and for interviews. interviews and to give seminars and lectures at universities and companies and institutes. So there's been a lot of requests, and unfortunately, time doesn't expand proportionally to the demands as they expand. So I have to unfortunately decline or defer a lot of these, and that's stressful because I hate letting people down. I hate disappointing people. And so that kind of comes with the territory. So that's the most sort of obvious impact. Also, it's interesting because there's things that I say, things that I have said for decades in my whole career that nobody paid attention to. But now when I say those same things as a Nobel laureate, I've noticed people take it a little bit more seriously, or maybe my words have more gravity. So that's a wonderful superpower to suddenly have ownership of. At the same time, I have to be very careful because people are listening to me for the first time. So it's interesting. But I would say, you know, it's been now a year and a half since October 5th, 2022. And things have sort of calmed down a bit. And a lot of the, you know, invitations and expectations and requests they've started to dissipate. Because there's a new crop of Nobel laureates who can get the attention as it should be. So I would say my life is slowly returning back to normal, you know.
Maybe we can return to something you brought up before, and that is the culture in laboratories, the culture in science, how that has evolved over the course of the past few decades, and also importantly, how it needs to continue to evolve. Now, even before the Nobel Prize, you've spoken candidly about how we can collectively create an environment that better fosters discovery and basic science, and also fosters a more diverse community of people pursuing scientific research and people who have a passion for science. And in particular, you've referred to diversity, both on this podcast and in other venues as well, as a superpower. And can you talk more about what this means in action and how you've created that environment in your laboratory and what others can learn from what you have done and what you are doing?
Yes, thank you for asking that. You know, I think my experience would be similar to many people of my generation, which is when I started out pursuing chemistry, you know, as my passion, the chemical sciences were not diverse in terms of the practitioners' representation. Very few women, you know, had been able to break into the field, and now I understand much better what those barriers feel like and look like because I've experienced them myself. And also there's a lack of racial diversity in the STEM disciplines in general. So people of color, you know, people who identify as underrepresented minorities, whether they're Black scientists or Latinx scientists, in our country, they're disproportionately underrepresented in the sciences. And I think that this is a detriment to scientific progress. Because first of all, it means that we're not taking advantage of the full talent pool in the sciences. And then also, we are not availing ourselves of the diversity of thinking, of ideas, of creativity that we could be if the sciences were more open and accessible to a broader swath of our society. And I feel very strongly about that. I've seen in action how diversity can accelerate creativity and scientific progress. And because it's so important, especially when you're solving really complicated, difficult problems, I think, you know, human health is a very challenging, difficult problem. It's difficult scientifically, and it's difficult economically, and it's difficult socially. And so to solve all of the vectors of the challenges of human health, we really do need the most diverse workforce we can avail ourselves of. So at Serafan ChemH, you know, we continue to work to enhance the diversity of our workforce. We try to do that at the level of our students. So we have graduate programs where we recruit a diverse student body to train the future generations of the people who will lead biomedicine. And we try to do it at the level of our faculty as well. So we, as you know, and you've been so supportive of us, we have recruited a diverse group of scientists, engineers, and physicians to work at Serafan ChemH. And I think there's a lot of magic and energy that you can feel when you have this kind of diversity. So I feel like we have made a lot of progress compared to where the field stood when I was a PhD student or an undergraduate. But you can look at the numbers even at Serafan ChemH, and we have a ways to go.
Now, when it comes to biomedical research, another important consideration is ensuring that discovery-based science, that is curiosity-driven science, continues to be supported along with clinical research and later stage translational research, clinical trials and related areas of study. So what do you think is the best way to ensure that knowledge-based research, curiosity-driven research, continues to be supported and advanced?
Well, yeah, you know, it's really important. And I've always been somewhat confused when people describe basic science and translational science as being in conflict or having tension. I never understood that.
I agree with you.
I don't know where the line is that separates those two things. There really shouldn't be one. If you don't do basic science, then there's nothing to translate anyways. And also, the process of translation, you know, which in my mind means, you know, bringing the science to the clinic, you know, bringing the molecules to the patients, bringing the patient to the device, right? That's the translational part. But you learn so much about human biology when you finally have the drug in patients right? Or when you take the patient's blood samples and analyze how the drug has affected them, you learn the basic science of human biology that way. So I think, you know, basic science, quote unquote, and translational science, quote unquote, are really just part of a virtuous cycle, right? Where the translation brings knowledge back about the human biology, which allows you to improve your ideas about patient care. So I would like to see that process reframed so that it's not a line from basic science to translation, but it's just a circle where the basic science and the translation just keep feeding each other and feeding each other, right? And it's just all of it is one cycle of science. I think that's how we should be framing it. And we want to continue the work we're doing at Stanford to erode these bridges between the basic sciences and the clinical sciences. You know, we're lucky because the people who are the practitioners in the clinic and the people who do research at the bench, we're all on the same campus at Stanford. We're in the same buildings, and in fact, we are in the same laboratories. We are side by side, next to each other, in the same cubicles and in the same laboratories. So we want to leverage every drop of the proximity advantages that we just have in the way our campus is designed. It's really exciting to see basic science and translation understood as a holistic process of improving human health.
Absolutely. I love your description about moving from a line to a circle. And of course, you've done that with your discoveries and your science. And maybe, Carolyn, could you describe the Inglai 2 story and how you became interested in that genetic disorder, and how, as a glycoprotein chemist, you did the fundamental discovery-based research all the way through translation?
Yeah, so this was one of the most rewarding experiences of my career in science. It started in 2015, so 9 years ago, when I moved to Stanford. And within a few weeks of my arrival, before I had even unpacked the boxes in my office, I had an email from a parent of a young daughter who had just been diagnosed with a rare genetic disease at Stanford Hospital. And she was the first patient ever to be identified with this genetic disease. So it was literally a newly discovered disease by the pediatric neurologist at Stanford who was treating her. And it was called NGLI1, so that's the name of the gene that's mutated in this genetic disease. And her father, so her name is Grace, and her father's name is Matt Wilsey, and he had communicated with me because he was forming a nonprofit foundation to sponsor research around this new disease. And it turns out the gene that's damaged in these patients relates to glycoscience, and that is an area that I have expertise in, which is why he reached out to me. And he said, listen, this is a glycoscience disease. We don't know much about glycoscience. We want to fund research to understand the disease better. Would you be interested in getting involved in this? And I was really intrigued by this. And also, it was a wonderful moment because the reason I moved to Stanford was to put myself closer to medical sciences and to clinical sciences, which I had no experience in. And I thought at Stanford I might learn more about, you know, the translational process and what it's like, you know, for patients and their doctors. And that happened within weeks of my arrival at Stanford, so it worked, you know. Yeah. And so, to make a long story short, my lab started working on that disease to just understand the basic biochemistry. And we made a discovery together with collaborators who were also being funded by the foundation, many of whom were also at Stanford, actually. So this really was very much a Stanford story. And eventually, we had learned enough about the disease that we had an idea for how to treat these patients. So Matt, the father of this young girl, Grace, he and I formed a biotech company called Grace Science LLC. And we hired people, professional drug discovery experts, to develop a gene therapy to treat these patients. And the first patient was dosed just about 3 weeks ago. So we now have one patient dosed with our gene therapy. We have another one scheduled for dosing in April, and then a third probably in May. So within the next few months, we'll start to get some early clinical data on how these patients are doing on the gene therapy. But so far, the first patient is doing very well. There were no problems, you know, with the treatment so far, and now we're just going to see if there's a benefit. So that came full story in about a 9-year span.
Congratulations. It's an amazing story. It's amazing accomplishments. And we'll all be eagerly awaiting the results of the trial and the follow-on research that I know you and your colleagues are going to continue to conduct.
Yeah.
So, Carolyn, I want to end with two questions that I ask all my guests. First, what do you think are the most important qualities for a leader today?
Wow, that's a big question. Well, I think a leader today needs to have very good listening skills. A leader today needs to be able to communicate with a diverse group of individuals from different backgrounds, different geographies. I think a leader today has to understand the position of their organization, not just locally, but globally, and has to really understand, you know, needs a vision really for where they can have the most impact, and has to be able to recruit and work with a diverse group of people to realize that impact. I think it's probably more important to have these, you know, we call them soft skills, but I don't think that's really a good way to describe them. I think the skills of understanding where people are at, where people are coming from, and to be able to organize people and motivate people to work as teams. Teamwork is very important today in this global world. I think organizations need to get away from traditional hierarchical structures and to have more kind of horizontals to go with their verticals, maybe is a way to put it. So there's a lot of challenges for leadership today. Yeah.
Thank you. Well, I think that's a great summary, and each one of the qualities that you mentioned, I think it are qualities that we can all relate to and incredibly important. And my second question is, what gives you hope for the future?
Oh, that's easy. What gives me hope for the future is watching how young people approach, you know, global problems and how young people see the world and act within it. I'm always very optimistic when I watch my students and I just see how passionate they are, the things they care about. They just seem to be very much more individually empowered compared to earlier generations. They're not afraid to vocalize their opinions. They avail themselves of social media to have a much broader reach in how they learn and how they communicate. So I love young people. I really feel like they understand that they're inheriting a world with a lot of challenges, and they seem really motivated to make a difference, which is great.
Well, Carolyn, thank you so much for joining me. And thank you for listening to the Miner Consult with me, Stanford School of Medicine Dean Lloyd Miner. I hope you enjoyed today's discussion with Carolyn Bertozzi, Nobel laureate, professor of chemistry, and director of Stanford Serafin Kim H. Please send your questions by email to theminorconsult@theminorconsult.com and check out our website, theminorconsult.com, for updates, episodes, and more. To get the latest episodes of The Miner Consult, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please rate the podcast 5 stars. Your feedback helps make this podcast happen. Thank you so much for joining me today. I look forward to our next episode. Until then, stay safe, stay well, and be kind.